I'm speaking with Charles Stansfer, who retired in 2005 as professor of history at the University of Kansas. We are in Lawrence, Kansas on October 13th, 2005. Where were you born and in what year?
I was born in 1930 in Garden City, Kansas.
What were your parents' names?
My father was Benjamin Harrison Stansfer, and my mother was Bernice Arlene Isabel Lucas.
What was your parents' educational background?
Very little. Neither of them had a high school education. My father finished the eighth grade and actually taught for a while in a rural school in western Kansas. But my mother, who lived in California when she was high school age, attended, I think, about one semester before her parents left and returned to Kansas, and she never went to high school again. So neither one of them had a high school education.
Mm-hmm. Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had one brother.
What was your father's occupation?
Surviving most of it, most of the time. He was raised a farmer and farmed during the 1920s, but in western Kansas, being a farmer was not very easy, and he left for Wichita and held a number of jobs in different places. Most of the time, simply, he was unemployed during the 1930s, and it wasn't until World War II when he got a job at Boeing Airplane Company as a sweeper. So his employment history is mainly with the WPA and whatever he could get at whatever time.
So the Depression really had an effect on your family then?
Definitely. Well, I was born in 1930. It was just ideal for to grow up during the Depression.
And then,
and my mother, of course, was a housewife. She never had outside employment.
Where did you attend elementary school? Did you grow up in Garden City then?
No, we left Garden City when I was 6 months old, so I know very little about Garden City. I grew up in the Wichita area, wherever my dad happened to be as a sometimes farmer or a farm hand in Rose Hill near Wichita and Burton near Wichita and in Garden Plain. Garden Plain is 20 miles west of Wichita, and that's basically where I grew up since I went there in the sixth grade and stayed through high school.
So your family, you've traveled a lot as an adult, but your family didn't travel much when you were young then.
That's right. Mainly back and forth from western Kansas to the Wichita area. And I did not leave Kansas until I was 18. And that was only to make a short trip to Oklahoma.
Oh, my. What do you remember about World War II on the home front? You said that your father was working at Boeing then and got a job.
I remember very little about World War II. The connections that come to mind as I have traveled in Germany and thinking about World War II mainly revert back to the comic strips. I remember reading in the comic strips about the Germans and saying Ach Himmel and things of that sort. and so the caricature of the Nazis in comic strips in World War II are basically my recollection. None of my family was directly involved in World War II, so I had no one in particular to be concerned with.
Yeah.
And when I was at Garden Plain High School, one of the students at Garden Plain had gone to war before he finished, and he was killed, and that was a major event, his funeral. And I remember that, but I never followed the war, never read newspapers, and didn't have much of an idea what was going on. Part of it was because I was working as well.
You said that you had had a lot of different jobs growing up.
Yes.
What were some of them?
Well, To start with, when my dad was a peddler of fruit in Wichita, driving a horse and carriage, I went along with him and helped to deliver the fruit.
Did he grow it on his...
No, we went to a market, and so we took it out to the for distribution primarily. So that was my first job, so to speak. And my second job was to sell ice cream bars at 1 cent a bar profit. And I did that when I was in during the middle of the 1930s.
Where did you sell them?
Well, I lived in an industrial district of Wichita. And so there were some industries where you could go into the factory.
Oh, I see.
Or business and sell ice cream bars. My brother, who was just 2.5 years older than I, we both had a route along the along this Washington Street in Wichita.
My goodness.
And I sold newspapers also, but this was more of an entertainment because if you sold newspapers at night in Wichita near the Forum Building, you could get free entrance to the wrestling matches. And so so that was one of my entertainments.
My goodness. Did you continue those jobs then when you were in high school?
Yes, indeed. I had jobs all during high school. But I should add that I left Wichita before I went to junior high, and I always regretted it because my brother had the opportunity to go to a junior high school where they taught carpentry and electricity and mechanical things. And I never took any of those things. And at Garden Plain, when I was there in the sixth grade, they didn't have anything like that vocational schools. So I went to school at Garden Plains in the starting in the sixth grade. And during that period, I had odd jobs. Fortunately, when you ask about World War II, I should have thought of this. Well, I got a job at a dairy farm, cleaning out the dairy barns when I was 11. And by 12, I had learned to drive the tractor. And in 1942, there were not so many people around who could drive tractors, and so I got a job at driving a tractor. And by 1943, I was making $10 a day driving a tractor, pulling a combine.
My goodness.
And I did plowing all day during the summer season. During the winter, I had a job at a lumber yard, and mainly moving things around. And when a boxcar load of cement came to town, another guy and I would haul the 90-pound sacks of cement from the boxcar into the storage unit. So that was one of my jobs.
Well, you certainly kept busy.
Yes. Well, we didn't have much to live on, and we had a house in Garden Plain, and we had chickens, and we had pigs. A couple of pigs, and so we raised our own, and we raised a garden. Uh-huh. So we were not starving.
Yeah.
We just didn't accumulate much wealth.
Yeah.
I forgot to mention that I carried a newspaper route. I delivered the Wichita Eagle, and my brother delivered the Beacon in Garden Plain. So we covered the whole town. It was a very small town.
Oh, my. Then when you were in high school, I know you've had foreign languages as an adult. Did you start studying foreign languages in high school?
Yes, actually, as a matter of fact, Latin.
Oh.
Because you wouldn't expect much from a little town of 300, but...
It was that small.
It was very small, but there happened to be a very good Latin teacher in that high school, and I took Latin, and it did have a very important effect on my career. I also had a very good English teacher as well. She happened to be the daughter of the superintendent of schools in our district, and she was very good. So I had two very good experiences with high school teachers.
I suppose you didn't have time for extracurricular activities, or maybe they didn't have them in a school that small.
Actually, it's the reverse, because if there are only 70 people in the high school, you have to be involved in everything.
Yeah, I guess so.
And so, for example, I was the tallest person in class when I was a freshman, so I naturally played center for the basketball team.
Uh-huh.
And I played basketball for 4 years at And I was the center for the 4 years and the high scorer at Garden Plain High basketball team. Not only that, I played end on the football team. I played first base on the baseball team, and I ran track. And I was in the boys' quartet. I sang in the choir. I participated in all the plays, and I edited the newspaper. Garden Plain Owl.
That's a lot.
So you you know you didn't have to have much talent because you were needed.
And, yeah.
There were only 16 in my senior class.
And so
it was almost obligatory that you participate in all of these events.
Did you have honors in high school, like valedictorian or anything like that?
You know, I don't remember anything like that. I did well in high school. I was urged by my parents to study. It was the thing to do to get out of the level of poverty. They emphasized it. And so I studied and enjoyed studying with these teachers that I knew, but I don't recall ever getting any honors. Being the editor of the newspaper was an honor.
Yeah, I suppose so. Did your parents then want you to go to college, or had you, did you always plan on going to college, even though you didn't have much money?
They prepared us to go to college. They both knew that education was the way out of this depressed situation. And so I don't know when, but very early on, I knew that I was going to college. And interestingly enough, there was only one person at Garden Plain High School had gone to college, and that was the person who was killed in the war.
Oh my.
So my brother was the first person from Garden Plain High School to actually complete college, and I was the second.
When did you graduate from high school?
1948.
And did you go directly on to college then?
Well, I had one more job.
Okay.
And it was an important job in terms of my career. I got a job on the Santa Fe Railroad as a Gandhi dancer during the summer of 1948. And so I worked...
And what does that mean?
That means you tamp ties and you take the... hammer and spike there and hit the railroad spikes when you're fixing the railroad.
Oh, uh-huh.
And you clean out the brush from the the streams that may be crowding and maybe endangered because of logs rolling down or coming down the stream.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was basically maintaining the railroad.
Yeah.
And I operated out of Goddard, and that covered from Goddard from Wichita to Kingman. And there was one other person, a gringo. All the rest of them were Mexican Americans. So I learned to swear in Spanish before I knew anything else in Spanish. This was a very important step in my career, since I had studied Latin and I picked up Spanish, at least a part of it.
Uh-huh.
And so when I went to college at the end of the summer, I automatically enrolled in a Spanish class.
Where did you go to college for your undergraduate?
Southwestern College in Winfield.
Was that a four-year school?
It's a four-year school.
Uh-huh.
However, I stayed only 2 years, and I switched to Wichita State after 2 years.
Why did you decide to go to Wichita State?
Well, my parents had lived in Garden Plain, but while I, in those first 2 years when I was at Southwestern, they moved to Wichita. And so it was cheaper for me to live at home and go to Wichita State than to go back and forth to Southwestern. And at Southwestern, I had jobs also.
Okay, what did you do there?
Well, I worked for the Winfield Floral Company, and my brother had preceded me, and so he worked as a nursery,
uh-huh.
And I worked there, and we also sold flowers at the football games. So
those mums?
Mums, yes.
Yeah,
chrysanthemums.
They used to have those when I was in college.
Yes, that was a big deal. I also was a clerk in the busboy there at college, and I was a dishwasher. So I did a number of odd jobs at the college.
What was your major when you were at this first college then?
Well, I didn't have a real firm decision. I I considered radio broadcasting, which I took courses in radio broadcasting. I took psychology, which really impacted me. I was really interested in that, and Spanish. And mm-hmm. and so I was drifting toward being a Spanish major, but I did not make that decision until I went to Wichita State.
And then you became a Spanish major.
I became a Spanish major at Wichita State, correct.
And when you decided to be a Spanish major, what did you envision yourself doing with that?
I don't know. I just like Spanish.
Oh, okay.
And I had a good teacher. He's still alive, Eugene Saviano. He's in his 90s. Oh, I just saw him the other few months ago in Wichita. I took every course that he offered. So there are a number of Spanish courses, and he also was of Italian descent, and so he taught an Italian course, so I took Italian. And so I was really smitten with the language. I took French also, and even won a prize as the best senior French student at Wichita State.
Oh my.
I studied Russian, and so I was really focused on languages. But I gradually realized that I didn't want to teach language. And so I sort of drifted into history at Wichita State, partly because of two very good and strong professors who influenced me at Wichita State.
So you decided to be a history major with the idea that maybe you would teach history someday, then?
Yes. Well, actually, I think I was really quite interested in international relations, and so I took political science and international relations. And I was thinking of going into the Foreign Service.
Oh, mm-hmm.
That was my intention, and it, in preparation, political science and history seemed to be the most important preparation. And so all through my BA career, that is the 2 years, 2.5 years I was at Wichita State and working for the BA, mm-hmm. I was thinking about a Foreign Service career. And I stayed at the MA level. And but by that time, I had switched to history completely. I majored in Spanish as an undergraduate, a BA in Spanish, but my master's degree was in history.
And that was at Wichita State?
At Wichita State.
And then also, did you have jobs, I suppose, at Wichita State also?
I actually not at Wichita State, but I got a job at the American Laundry, and so I worked at night cleaning the laundry.
Oh, my.
And I also had a job at Fox Fleet Drugstore as a clerk, and so I worked in the afternoon at Fox Fleet Drugstore, and I worked at night cleaning the laundry. I could clean the laundry at any time during the night after 5 p.m., so and I usually let it cool down and worked from 10:30 to 12 cleaning the laundry.
You must not have needed much sleep.
Well, I didn't seem to need much sleep. No, I never... I got by on 5 to 6 hours a night.
Now, when did you get your undergraduate degree then?
In 1953. It took me, because of the switch from Southwestern to Wichita State, I didn't finish in the four-year time. It was mm-hmm. 4.5 years. Uh-huh. And I went on, so I finished my BA requirements and then began my master's work the last semester and tack on one more year, and I finished the MA.
Did you have to write a thesis for your
master's? I did indeed. And I wrote a thesis on Herbert Hoover's policy of recognition of new governments in Latin America.
Oh.
A rather esoteric topic.
Uh-huh.
But it had to do with relations, U.S.-Latin American relations.
Uh-huh.
So it fit my background in Spanish. And I was very interested in the 1920s and the 1930s. And so I had a very good instructor, in John L. Ridgeord at Wichita State, who was at one time the chair of the history department and one time dean of the graduate school. And so I finished my degree with him.
And then you got your master's in what year?
1954.
So then what did you do?
Well, the Korean War was going on. Actually, it was winding down at this time.
Uh-huh.
And so while I was finishing my degree, I guess two things were going on. I had a full-time job my last year at Boeing Airplane Company.
While you were working on your master's?
Yes, I was I was a supplementary training technician. And my job was to administer the program to the teachers. And so I didn't teach, but the Boeing taught shop math and blueprint reading to people who didn't know how to read blueprints.
Uh-huh.
So I scheduled the classes and paid the instructors, and I also gave demonstrations at Boeing. And I'll just, this is a very interesting aspect of my career, which sort of led me to history as well. We had an individual at Boeing who was the author of a book called Stop Forgetting. And he was interested in improving people's memory.
Oh.
and getting them to read faster.
Uh-huh.
Rapid reading was big in those days.
I see.
So he gave rapid reading courses and memory courses.
Uh-huh.
I was the guinea pig for the memory courses. You'd be amazed at what you could do if you focus on it. For example, he would give memory courses to 30 instructors. And I would stand at the door and greet each one of them at the door and to get their names, shake their hands, and then he would go through various things. And then when they left, 45 minutes later, I would tell them goodbye and mention their names.
Oh, my.
It was a good preparation for being a teacher.
Because I suppose. He gave you ideas on how to do this.
Yes. Well, it was a technique that he taught.
Yeah.
He had a technique so that you can remember telephone numbers. And believe it or not, Boeing Airplane Company asked me to demonstrate that you could memorize 150 telephone numbers so you didn't have to waste time looking them up in the telephone directory. So I memorized the exact population of every capital in the 48 states at that time, just as a demonstration. It's amazing what you can do if you have a technique.
I suppose.
So I don't remember these now, but I could apply the technique still, and sometimes do.
You were talking about the Korean War. Did you get drafted then?
No, I didn't. Of course, I registered, and I was fearful of getting drafted, and so I tried to get in the Naval Intelligence.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't fail. I failed the test. I couldn't see as well as I was supposed to. But by the time all that happened, the Korean War was pretty much winding down, and they didn't want naval intelligence officers anyway. And so I thought the smartest thing for me to do was to go to graduate school to get a PhD.
So where did you go for that?
Well, I remember that I had opportunities at Ohio State and Berkeley and Florida and Tulane. And I didn't particularly like Ohio State or Florida. I thought very seriously about Berkeley. But to get a PhD at Berkeley at that time, you had to study German. Okay, I had studied Spanish and French and Portuguese and Italian. I didn't see the need.
Yeah.
And even Russian, I didn't see the need of learning German at that point just to satisfy their degree requirement.
Yeah.
Besides, at Tulane, there were two advantages for me there. I had written on a Central American topic, and this was one place in the United States where there was a strong interest in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And my mentor, Ridgeord, whose degree was from Berkeley, knew someone who was also from Berkeley at Tulane. And so the Berkeley connection guided me to Tulane.
Now, where is Tulane located?
It's in New Orleans.
Oh, it is in New Orleans,
yes. Yes. So that was the big cultural shock in my life, moving from Kansas to New Orleans.
It's a very different place.
Very, very different, yes.
Probably not a lot of Spanish speakers, or are there?
No, well, there's a sizable Latin American community, but it's very old, and so they have pretty much mixed with the local population. Part of the cultural shock was I got married just at the finish of my master's degree, and so my wife and I left on our honeymoon in August of 1954, and ended up in New Orleans.
What is her name?
Mary Ellen Love was her name. Unfortunately, she died in 2001.
Where did you meet her at Wichita then?
Yes, she was a student. She was a Spanish student at Wichita.
Oh, she studied. I didn't know that.
And actually, one of the other steps in preparing my life situation was in 1952, when she and I were on the same trip to Mexico.
Oh, you did have a chance to travel then to a Spanish-speaking country?
Yes,
in school.
Yes, this would have been when I was in my second year at Wichita State, and I was a Spanish major, and she was a Spanish major, and the secretary of the president of the university organized this trip to Mexico with two cars. There were only about eight of us. Mm-hmm. And so we drove all the way to Mexico City and to Acapulco. And while the rest of them went to Acapulco, I separated myself. And this was with great laughter and derision. I stayed to do research at the library in Mexico City.
Well, that must have been an interesting experience. Mexico is very different.
Mexico was very different, and I learned that although I knew some Spanish, I realized I didn't know well enough to have a decent conversation. Uh-huh. So I knew I had to work harder.
So you went to Tulane then as a Spanish major?
No, I was
a history major,
but my intent was still Foreign Service. I mm-hmm. enrolled as a history major with the intent of preparing myself for the Foreign Service exam and going into the Foreign Service. I wanted to be a diplomat.
Oh. And you were married at this time?
Yes. I was married on August 21st, 1954, and we arrived on August 31st in 54 at Tulane. It happened to be the hottest day of the year.
In New Orleans?
In New Orleans.
Hot.
Hot and muggy.
Yeah. So what were you specifically studying as a doctoral student then?
Well, to get a PhD in history, you have to study different fields of history. And at Tulane and at some other schools, you prepare yourself for an area. Mm-hmm. And Latin America obviously was my area, so I took courses in archaeology and anthropology and the language and so forth, of course, in economics of Latin America and things of that sort. So it was a general studies focused on Latin America, while the degree was in the history department.
Uh-huh. And what did you write your dissertation on then as a PhD student?
I wrote my dissertation on the Central American career of E. George Squire. And Squire happened to be a diplomat who served in Nicaragua in 1849-1850.
Oh.
And they happened to be considerable amount of materials available at Tulane.
Oh.
There's an institute at Tulane called the Middle American Research Institute, and they had several collections of Squire's material. Now, I didn't intend to do a dissertation on Squire. I had other intentions. I wanted to do a history of the United Fruit Company. And that's the explanation for this is that my mentor, who happened to be a native Kansan, William J. Griffith, took me to a party on a banana boat within weeks after I arrived at Tulane. And I was fascinated by the United Fruit Company and bananas and the connection between Central America and the United States.
Uh-huh.
But I gradually realized that the United Fruit Company was not very eager to have anybody get into their archives to explain what they were doing.
Yeah.
They never admitted that they had any records, and so I eventually had to abandon that, and so I switched to E. George Squire.
Uh-huh.
I have a footnote on that, if you'll permit.
Sure.
I wrote my dissertation and published a few articles on him, and when I came to KU in 1963, I got a grant to study at the Huntington Library, because there's some Squire materials there. But believe it or not, in 2004, 40 years later, I got another grant to go back to the Huntington Library to study those materials again, and I'm currently writing a biography of E. George Squire.
Oh, my.
Believe it or not, there's still room for a published book on this man. he's worth it, and I'm working on it right now.
Oh, that's great. Where did you live? Did they have married student housing, or did you?
They did. And so these were old World War II barracks that we lived in. In New Orleans. So it was a very communal operation. Most of the graduate students lived there, and Tulane had a very good medical school, and so there were quite a few medical students in that in our barracks. Stadium place, as it was called.
Oh.
It was right by the Sugar Bowl.
My goodness. Did you have children while you were in graduate school?
Yes. Two children were born. Only one during graduate school. That was my son, Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And I should explain that I didn't go to the Foreign Service. I got talked out of it at the last minute. And a job opened up at Southwestern Louisiana Institute in Lafayette, and I took a job in 1958 just before I finished the PhD, and my second child was born in Lafayette.
Did you start teaching then when you were a graduate student, as people often do?
Yes. Well, my first job as a graduate student was to be an editorial assistant at the Mississippi Valley Historical Review. And that was partly because the director of the Mississippi Valley Historical Review was another Berkeley PhD. All of these individuals that I worked with had their PhDs from the same man at Berkeley.
Oh.
So there was kind of a neat colony there or family. So for 2 years, I took courses, I was an editorial assistant. And then in my third year, I became a teaching assistant. So I did have some teaching experience.
Mm-hmm. And when did you get your PhD?
1959.
And then you went to...
I was already teaching at...
I
started in 1958.
I see.
And I finished the dissertation during the Christmas break and defended it in the spring of 1959.
And how long were you at this school that you first taught at?
I was there until 1963. I finished the spring of 1963, but at that point I got a grant from the Doherty Foundation to go to Chile. And by that time I had pretty much concluded that there was no job available in Central America with a Central American emphasis, and so I was retooling as a South American specialist while I was in Chile.
Were you working at a university then in Chile?
No, I had it was a research grant. The Doherty Foundation provides support for young graduate students to do research in Latin America, and so the grant paid for. It was a minimum grant, but it allowed for us to stay for 9 months in Santiago de Chile.
So you and your wife and two children were in Chile for
yes,
9 months.
For 9 months, yes.
How did you like living in Chile?
Well, we all loved it. In the first place, it was what I needed to improve my Spanish, because my Spanish was still pretty much academic, and so I had an opportunity to use it on a daily basis. And we were able to travel up and down Chile. The trains were very cheap, and that was fun. And my oldest son was in an English language school, sort of half English, half Spanish. And they emphasized math at the first grade much more than they would in the United States. And he later became a computer scientist. So I think that it did have an impact on him as well.
And let's see, what was your daughter's name then?
Mary Lee was born in 1960, and while I was in Lafayette.
Mm-hmm.
She became a professor also.
Of what?
She's a professor of business at the University of Colorado.
Okay. So then you were about, was it 4 years then, or 5 years at this school?
Technically, I was still there until the fall of 1963, but I had already interviewed for the job at Kansas before I left for Chile.
Oh.
And I got word that I had been hired while I was in Chile. And so I came back in the in August 1963 just to pick up stuff in Lafayette, Louisiana, and come up here to Lawrence.
How did you happen to get a job here?
Well, believe it or not, in 1963, there were 7 positions in the history department open.
You mean at this, at KU?
At KU.
Oh.
They were in different fields. But this was exactly the time when the University of Kansas was expanding into the international arena. They had just gotten a grant from the Ford Foundation to emphasize international relations. And there was sort of a mix-up with respect to Latin America. And there was a visiting professor at KU during 62-63. And there was a permanent professor who was in Costa Rica serving as director of the Peace Corps, and they didn't think he was coming back. So there was a long rigmarole there, but eventually they decided to hire me because they, by that time, the University of Kansas had made a firm connection with Costa Rica, and believe it or not, to my amazement, they wanted a Central Americanist. So I dropped to South American and went back to Central America, and that was exactly where I belonged. The 2 universities in the United States that emphasize Central America are Tulane and Kansas.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So then you came here in 63.
Right.
What did you think of Lawrence? It was very different at that time than it is now, isn't it?
I thought I had reached heaven.
Really?
Well, I mean, I wanted to get out of Kansas desperately when I was in Wichita.
Oh.
Because I didn't like Wichita. I didn't like Kansas, but comparing it to Louisiana, I began to think that it might be better to be in Kansas. And I had been to northern Kansas often enough to know that it was different in Lawrence. And of course, there's a big difference between the University of Kansas and the other places I had been.
Sure.
And so it was a wonderful opportunity. And the combination of being focused on Central America and being a prestigious university I was delighted.
What sort of courses were you teaching here?
Well, I actually, despite what I've just said, I had a little difficulty persuading the history department that Central America was that important. But it didn't take long, and by the next year I had persuaded him that I should offer a course in the history of Central America.
So you originated that course?
I did. Actually, it was the first course in the history of Central America taught in the United States.
Oh, really?
Even at Tulane, Professor Griffith taught a course that included Central America, but he called it Middle America, and he included the Caribbean and Mexico. But mine was the first course that only dealt with the 5 republics of Central America. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as I know, that's correct. I've never seen any other evidence that anybody else has taught a course like that early.
So you were here then when all the protests and things were happening in the late 60s.
Yes.
You've been here a while.
Yes.
How did that affect you or your family or your students or your department?
Well, it didn't really affect me that much. I am a pacifist, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I let the Vietnam War, which I disagreed with, sort of go by without paying much attention to it. I got excited when the United States was involved in Central America, but in the case of Vietnam, I slept through this. And I kind of look back on it and I think, well, how could this happen? How did I do this? But I was focused on my research and focused on teaching. And so I walked up and down the streets and saw people protesting, but didn't involve myself. I do remember the events of 1970 very well because I was on watch at Strong Hall one night, and I happened to sleep through the burning of the Union in 1970. But I had a visitor here in the spring of 1970 from California, Berkeley. And I remember that he was here when we closed it down. We closed down the university in the spring of 1970. So, no, I didn't have much of a reaction. to Vietnam. I opposed it, but I didn't do anything about it. When the Contra War came along in the 1980s, I was much more involved.
How do you mean involved? I mean, you had opinions about it, obviously, but you taught about it?
Well, I brought a number of Nicaraguans here to give talks. By this time, by 1975, I had become the director of the Center of Latin American Studies. So I was in a position to have more impact on what happened in the not only history, but in the other fields where the Latin American studies had an impact. And so I brought a political scientist here from Nicaragua, who had actually been a KU PhD. And since he was a member of the Sandinista Party, local people called me a communist because I had brought a communist here.
Oh.
And so it's kind of laughable. But this is the sort of thing that you experience when you sort of reach out and try to get different opinions expressed. And during the period of the Reagan administration, when the government was committed to bringing the Sandinista government down in Nicaragua, I knew Nicaragua very well. I'd spent a lot of time there, and I knew both sides of the issue. I tried to be neutral, but nobody saw you as neutral when you had friends on both sides.
You said you had spent a lot of time in Nicaragua. Is this in the summers, then, that you would go to Central America?
Well, first of all, I should say that I was really committed to the Costa Rican program, and I was director of the Costa Rican exchange year in 1966 and again in 1974. So I taught U.S. history in Spanish at the University of Costa Rica on two different occasions.
So you lived down there during the school year then?
Yes,
and
the whole year.
And taught, and your family too then?
Yes, yes indeed. So by this time I had four children.
And who are your other?
John is number three, and he is a would-be screenwriter in Hollywood. And my daughter Karen finished her MA in History of Art here at KU, and she's married to a Frenchman and lives in Denver. And she has three young children, so she's not employed outside the home. She's employed inside the home.
Yeah. So you were teaching in Costa Rica then, and the students would go down and spend a year there?
Yes.
Was this history students or Spanish students?
In whatever field, most of them were Spanish students. The idea mainly was to improve their Spanish. But quite a few history and political science students also studied there. I have to say that this program is the most successful exchange relationship in the hemisphere. It goes deeper, and it has been operating longer, and it has been very, very successful. And I'm very proud of Kansas for being this closely connected to Costa Rica. And Costa Rica became my second home. I've been to Costa Rica 80 times.
Really?
And then on those two occasions, I lived the whole year there, but I've been there practically every year since 1965. And it's amazing because I finished my dissertation at Tulane without ever having gone to Central America. But at Kansas, I had lots of opportunities, and I took them to go to Central America.
What do you do when you go there? Is this you're doing research or writing or something?
Well, I had administrative responsibilities, I had something to do with the administering of the study abroad program and encouraging people to study there. So and we did a number of, I wrote grant proposals connecting, strengthening the connection between Kansas and Costa Rica.
Do people from Costa Rica come here then also?
Indeed, they do. We have something like 800 or 900 graduates from Costa Rica.
Really?
Yes. And so one of the things that I've been involved in even post-retirement is trying to organize an alumni group in Costa Rica.
Costa Rica?
I was there last January working on that, and I plan to go back this coming January.
So you really like living in Costa Rica then?
Yes. I do. And at one point seriously considered retiring in Costa Rica, but my wife wasn't particularly interested in it, and with all four kids here in the United States, it just seemed to be too much. By the way, I like Lawrence very much, too.
Oh, sure. You've mentioned that you were you were the head of the Latin American Studies program.
From 1975 to 1989.
And what did this involve?
Well, the main idea was to bring money from the outside to Kansas in order to promote Latin American studies. And so the first assignment that I took for myself was to get a grant from the Department of Education as a international resource center. And by 78 or 79, I was successful. And I'm very pleased with this because the Russian Studies Program and the East Asian Studies Program already had this money when I took over as Latin American director. And after a few years, all three of the international programs had federal funding. And that's one of the stars in KU's alignment, because having three funded resource centers in international studies is very unusual.
Yeah. And why do you think international studies then are so important?
Well, I don't think you can live in a world as tightly connected as it is now without knowing something about the rest of the world. And I just think it's very important multiculturally. And I think our foreign relations, obviously, as the world's only superpower, it's just extremely important that we know what is going on and what is motivating people in other cultures, not only Latin America, of course, but in all cultures.
Do you think students are becoming more interested in international studying or traveling there?
I think basically since the 1960s, when KU began this push to develop international programs, there has been a steady increase in information and in study. Had a tremendous impact in opening up Kansas, and so you may remember that just recently Dolph Simons has been complaining that we don't have enough foreign language. What? We have more foreign language than every other Big 12 school, except perhaps Texas. And it started back in the 1960s.
Oh, really?
We are way in ahead of Colorado or Missouri or Nebraska in terms of the number of languages spoken and the depth of these language programs. And no other university in the immediate vicinity has three international programs that are funded by the federal government.
Really?
Yes. So that's one last point.
Sure.
And I'm drifting into comment on KU at this particular time. But the chancellor has announced that we are the fourth in the United States in terms of the number of students who participate in foreign study programs. And
yeah,
so we may not rank as high in some commodities or in some areas, but the number of students who participate abroad is very high. And it's been consistent in the case of the Kansas Costa Rica program.
Have you been specifically in charge of students while they're abroad, or are you mostly like here arranging it or there?
Well, on those two occasions, back in 1966 and in 1974, I was in charge of I was director of the program in Costa Rica. I did direct one program in England.
How did you happen to go to England?
Well, at that time, I was chair of the history department, and this was in 1969. And the study abroad program, the humanities program in England, is alternated between the history of art, the English department, and the history department.
Mm-hmm.
And so the director comes from one of these departments.
I see.
So in 1969, it was history's turn. And to my amazement, nobody in the history department wanted to do this. And so I had been to England, but not for any length of time. And so I decided, and my wife really loved England, and so I decided to apply for it. And so I became the director. I knew something about English history, not very much.
But so probably had other people. Did you have other people teaching?
Yes.
It?
Well, we have three TAs. Ordinarily, you have two TAs, and the other person teaches. In this case, we had three TAs, and I mainly directed. And I had directed study tours in Peru and in Ecuador.
Oh, really?
So I'd had this experience, so I didn't think it was going to be that difficult. And so I'd lectured from time to time, but I was giving the Spanish version of English history. The Spanish Armada from the Spanish side as opposed
really?
To the English side.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, well, it was fun.
How do you find the students? Do they do all right abroad? Do they get in trouble sometimes? Or?
Well, I think you have to make a generalization, and my experience is that most students that I have known abroad have done very well. There have always been some losers, a small number of losers.
Yeah.
In the case of 66 and 74 in Costa Rica, I'd say the vast majority got a lot out of it, and maybe one or two or three didn't get much out of it, or didn't react very well to it. In one or two cases, we had to send the student back for not adjusting. But generally speaking, it works very well.
And then they did have that one death in Costa Rica.
Yes. Well, that was a very special circumstance. And yes, it happened on my bailiwick. And even though I had no responsibility for that particular program, that's the tropical research program in Gofito.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I knew Gofito very well because I'd been there on many occasions. And as a matter of fact, I had been negotiating with the United Fruit Company, and this is one of those odd circumstances. The United Fruit Company offered us at KU the whole town at one time. And it was really pretty crazy, but we had to turn it down. But
they wanted you to buy the town?
No, they wanted to give it to us. 48 houses, an airport, and a swimming pool.
And how come they turned it down?
Well, we didn't have any basis for managing it. And number two, since there's a very antagonistic attitude toward United Fruit Company in Central America, it would have been very unwise for the University of Kansas to have taken over the United Fruit Company town, and all that cultural baggage would have flown negatively toward us. So it wasn't a very smart thing to do. But what we did finally do was to persuade United Fruit Company to give it to the government of Costa Rica to help us establish the University of Costa Rica and the University of Kansas set up a tropical research program. And we did, and it worked very well for quite a while, but this unfortunate murder took place, and that basically ended that program. And I went down as a representative of KU to study the situation.
Uh-huh.
And it was since she had been killed after going to a bar. It was the first time that I'd ever been paid to go do a research at bars.
Oh.
So, the low life of Gofito. Anyway, I concluded, like almost everybody else did, that there was nothing terribly dangerous about Gofito any more than Topeka or Kansas
yeah.
City or Lawrence. But it did leave a stain. It's a small town, and it took a long time to recover from it. And personally, I didn't think it was such a good idea to have that tropical research program based in Gofito anyway, because the people in San Jose, the best teachers at the University of Costa Rica, really did not pay much attention to Gofito. If you wanted to have a good, solid program, better to be in San Jose and then do field trips. And that's exactly what we're doing now. I'm pleased that we kept the program and strengthened it by moving it back to San Jose.
Oh. You said you were chairman of the history department. When was that?
It was 1993 to 1996.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't such a smart thing to do.
Why was that?
Well, I clashed with the administration on a regular basis. And it wasn't very much fun. People generally conclude that one of the worst jobs in the university is being chairman of a department, and after being chair for 3 years, totally different than in the case of the Center of Latin American Studies. I was my own man. I got my own money, and I I didn't have nobody at the college office was happy because I brought money in. Well, uh-huh. It's hard to get money into the history department, and they're very much concerned about the way things are going, and no way for the chair of the department to do the things that they wanted. This gets very personal, but I mean, I have a bad memory of a number of incidents that occurred in this period.
I understand that you've brought Latin American leaders then to speak at KU. You talked about the Sandinistas.
Yes.
People from other countries come here and speak then too.
Well, I have brought during that period when I was chair of the department, I brought the U.S. ambassador from Paraguay.
Oh.
We have a relationship with Paraguay as well as Costa Rica.
You mean students go there to study?
Mainly it's the Paraguayans who come here, but a few Gansans go to Paraguay.
I see.
And I had the privilege of signing the original agreement back in the 1970s with two universities in Paraguay. It's a reciprocal arrangement. But the fact is, more Paraguayans are interested in coming here than Kansans are interested in going there. So it's a little out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it needs to be redrawn. The whole agreement needs to be redrawn.
Mm-hmm.
But the Paraguay does offer some advantages that Costa Rica does not. It is really quite different. It tends to be more dictatorial. Costa Rica is sort of the flower child of Latin America, the most important democracy, and on the other hand, the least important, the least democratic of the Latin American countries is Paraguay, so it's the opposite, a completely different circumstance.
Uh-huh.
So if you want to understand Latin America, you ought to know both sides of the spectrum. I've just come back from a two-week tour of Paraguay, so I'm very much focused on Paraguay right now.
Oh, really? What were you doing?
Well, my partner and I and a couple from Newton arranged a historical cultural tour of Paraguay. So we spent 2 weeks touring the country, and since most of the people who were involved in the tour had been to Paraguay before and had close connections, it was really a fun thing to do. I mean, we knew a lot of people and walk in music and in engineering and agriculture and sociology. I met a lot of former students. So it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work, too.
Oh, I suppose, too, and responsibility if you're in charge of a tour of people.
Yes, well, my partner is treasurer, and I'm the historian of the group. I once was president of the organization. And we just came back from Topeka in order to do this because I spent the day, most of the day, doing research in the archives in Topeka because all the Kansas Paraguay documents are over in the History Museum in Topeka.
Oh, you say Kansas Paraguay, you mean the relationship between the two?
This is, we are sister states.
I didn't know that.
We failed to get the word out.
I mean, I've heard of this German connection and the connection with Japan.
Those are sister cities.
Oh, okay.
And so there's
I didn't know there was a sister state.
It's our fault.
Well, Paraguay is a country, though, isn't it?
Yes, well, sister state, call it. I mean, the nomenclature is not quite accurate, but this has been operating for 40 years.
I didn't know that.
There are six, I told you about 800 Costa Ricans who are graduates of KU. There are 600 Paraguayans who have graduated from the six region schools.
Uh-huh.
In the case of Paraguay, I made a very strong point when I was director of the center that we should cooperate with the other region schools. By that time, we had a program operating called TUCLAS, the Tri-University Center of Latin American Studies, involving Wichita State and Kansas State. And so Paraguayan students are admitted as equally as Kansas residents in all six of the region schools.
Oh, really?
So they've been coming up in great numbers lately.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, not many cancers are going there.
Do they have much for universities in Paraguay?
The universities in Paraguay are much worse than the ones in Costa Rica. So essentially, to explain why Kansas students go to Costa Rica and not to Paraguay, there are two reasons. It's much costlier to go to Paraguay. It's farther.
Sure.
And the universities are much better in Costa Rica than in Paraguay.
Uh-huh.
As you might imagine, if one is a democracy and one has been a dictatorship.
And then I believe that you mentioned William Griffith, and he was at KU also, wasn't he?
Yes, that was a most unusual situation because I left Wichita State, where John Ridyard was my mentor, to go to Tulane, where William Griffith was my mentor. Griffith had been to Wichita State as well, and he is a native Kansan. So when he had difficulties with Tulane in the early 1970s, he was looking for a position, and they wanted, at KU, we wanted to strengthen Latin America, and so we hired Griffith. So that was a most unusual situation to be a mentor and student in the same department, in the same field.
Uh-huh.
And it lasted only for about 6 years before he retired. But he came here as director of the Center of Latin American Studies, so he wasn't teaching as much as I was.
I see. And then you became the director after
when he retired.
After he retired.
I succeeded him. And he was very, very gentlemanly about it. He the measure of success of a faculty member is graduate students. Mm-hmm. And so when he came here, he said, I am not taking any graduate students. And so all the graduate students who worked in Central America worked with me in that five-year period. And when you were asking me about students, and I was talking mainly about undergraduates, but I think I'm most proud of the number of graduate students, PhDs and MAs, that have studied Central America here.
Yeah, I always ask people if you remember students who've gone on to greater things, been particularly successful, that kind of thing. Are there any that come to mind?
Yes, indeed. I think I wouldn't say so many of them have gone on to greater things. They've gone on to other places and succeeded in their lives. Richard Salisbury was at Western Kentucky University. They didn't have a PhD program, but he won the award as the best teacher in the 1 year. And Marshall Aiken won such an award at Vanderbilt University, and he has been very successful. And he's been the chair of the department at, he was an MA student of mine. He went on to UCLA for his PhD. And then Larry Laird, who retired before I retired. He got his PhD in 1974 and went to AID and served in several different countries in Latin America. That's the Agency for International Development. Mm-hmm. And he served in Paraguay and Costa Rica and Barbados and the Dominican Republic and has gotten very good recommendations everywhere he's been. So, yes, there's a long list of students that I think have succeeded.
Have you had publications? Did you ever write a book?
I edited a book on Costa Rica. It's a bibliography of Costa Rica. And I edited a couple of other books, but I have a lot of articles, but I've never published one that would be a solid academic book. I'm going to do that after I retire. I got too deeply involved in administration.
Oh.
I think that was a mistake. It was a double mistake in that it didn't, financial rewards for being at that level of administration are very poor.
But it takes a lot of your time.
And it takes a lot of time.
Yeah. And you had said, do you talk with, I read somewhere that you had talked with federal legislatures about how, U.S. policy affected Latin America?
Especially in the 80s during the Cold War. I was very close to Jim Slattery.
Oh, wow.
And Senator Kassebaum. At least they listen to me. Some do and some don't.
Yeah.
In the case of Senator Dole, he wouldn't talk to me. He knew what I was going to say, and so he wouldn't even let me step in the door.
You've traveled a lot. Was some of this on sabbatical? Did you ever have sabbaticals?
Yes, I had sabbaticals, and I spent a year or a semester in Nicaragua. So, and I was there. This was particularly important to me because I was in Nicaragua in the first year of the revolution.
Oh.
And so it was a fascinating experience to witness the revolution.
I suppose. I mean, it sounds rather dangerous.
Well, it got more dangerous later, but personally, I never had any really negative experiences in Nicaragua, even though there was a very bad relationship between Nicaragua and the United States. Mm-hmm. But that there are a lot of anti-Americanism around, and but if you're known as a person who teaches Latin American history, in the case of Costa Rica, I've experienced it to a certain extent, but most people recognize that that my interest in Central America and Costa Rica is very strong, and I don't particularly have a foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
I often say that the U.S. has a foreign policy, but Kansas doesn't. So I can't be blamed for for what I can't control.
Well, that's reasonable, certainly.
Yeah.
Have you had honors?
Yes. I have had honors. I brought you a list, I think. Well, it looks like I forgot it. I have had awards from Nicaragua and from Costa Rica and from Paraguay.
Oh, really?
And I just...
For your work with students?
Mainly student exchange.
Student exchange. Yes.
And I was very pleased at receiving an award from the Partners of the Americas, a Lifetime Achievement Award that was announced in Guatemala early this year. And the two awards at the Huntington Library were very, very nice, very, very pleasant. Also provided money to pay the cost of the trip to California. That was nice.
And I think I read somewhere you, in 1999, you had the Provost's International Leadership Award.
Yes.
I suppose you were on committees. Are there any you particularly remember?
Well, I served on the International Leadership Award Committee after getting that award.
Oh.
And that was fun to see the nominations come in from different parts of the university. But the most important committee that I've served on two committees that I felt very strongly about. One was student exchange, international student exchange.
Oh, uh-huh.
And the other is the Senate Library Committee. And I've been very involved in library acquisitions.
Oh, really?
And I still am.
For Central America, you mean?
For all of Latin America, but primarily Central America.
Uh-huh.
So, from the moment I arrived here in 1963, I began to strengthen the Central American collection. And I believe that it is one of the top three in the nation now. Partly it's because of a circumstance. When Griffith retired, he sold his library to KU, and I was director of the Center of Latin American Studies at that time, and I helped to steer this through and found money to buy it. And he arranged so that he gave part of it and sold part of it so he could get a tax write-off. But anyway, it's one of the strongest Guatemalan collections in the world, right here in Spencer Library. And then when he died, he died without heirs. And so he left $320,000 to the Central American Collection. In the meantime, I learned that if you purchased everything coming out of Central America, it wouldn't be that expensive. And so way back in about 1970, I persuaded the university to buy everything that he could get his hands on Central America. So our collection may not be as strong for publications in the colonial period, but from the last 35 years, our collection is very strong on all Central American countries. Probably
so
number
these,
one.
These Costa Rica. Are like magazines and books and whatever they're writing?
In every field.
Really?
Yes, every field. But in the case of Costa Rica, almost everything published, even children's literature.
My goodness.
So, I mean, the library usually balks when they... when you say you want to buy recipes or something like that. But I've been able to persuade them that in the case of Costa Rica and beyond, cuisine, history of cuisine is growing in importance. So we do buy recipes, cookbooks.
Why?
And children's literature, well, yes, that's part of education. So
yeah.
So anyway, we have a very comprehensive collecting policy on Central America. But I gave a lecture this past spring on acquisitions on Latin America, and I have a long list of items, rare collections that I purchased for Spencer. And I'm still doing it. I was doing it 2 weeks ago in Paraguay. I bought some rare items that will eventually go to Spencer.
You buy them from what, museums or college libraries? Or
Anywhere I can find them. I go to the bookstores, I go to the used bookstores, and I purchase from individuals and museums. If you know the library acquisitions policy, they usually have an agent who buys from bookstores. So there's sort of a sweep through and you buy what is available. But they often miss small university publications and institute publications, religious publications, and so that's what I do. I clean up the things that they miss.
So you have a specific fund for this then?
Yes, my fund.
Oh.
I buy them.
Oh, I see. And then you give them to the...
Well...
Or sell them, or...
It works both ways. I have 15,000 books in my own collection.
Oh, my.
And most of that is on Central America.
Uh-huh.
Lately, I've been purchasing books from Honduras to build up the Honduras collection in Spencer. And so I got $25,000 from the Endowment Association, and with between SPLAT and the Spain, Portugal, Latin America section and Spencer, we've purchased probably about $30,000 worth of books on Honduras. We now have one of the largest collections on Honduras. Now, I have a lot of, in my collection, my collection on Nicaragua is very strong, and it's relatively weak in Spencer, so I probably will give that. I gave my Chilean collection, donated my Chilean collection to, that's what I collected in the 1960s. And I have... I've donated a lot of things.
You said you had 15,000 books. Where on earth would you put all that stuff?
Well, you should come to my office.
You kept it at KU at your...
Well, all of my Costa Rican books are in my office. I have the record for getting more books in one office than anybody at KU.
Oh, yeah, most KU offices wouldn't be big enough to hold.
Well, you should come see my office. But my one room in my house is the Nicaraguan room. The other room is the Honduras room. And another room is the banana room, because I collect on banana history.
Oh, you do?
Yes. I have a I have a very large collection of banana memorabilia in literature. I give a humorous lecture on bananas in my courses.
Oh.
And I still do. I've been doing this for 30 years.
Something about the United Fruit Company?
Well, not particularly. Just bananas are funny.
Oh. I never thought of it that way.
Well, I make up a lot of stuff, too.
Okay.
Think of Carmen Miranda.
Oh, yeah. That's a while ago. Your students probably haven't heard of that.
I have to explain Carmen Miranda, too. But you'd be amazed at how many cartoons there are that have bananas as the theme. And I've collected political cartoons I have cartoons with Reagan and Nixon and Clinton and Hillary, all unrelated to bananas.
I didn't know that.
Well, you should come see my collection.
Have you been involved in community activities?
Not so much. I once was a financial manager for a city commissioner campaign.
Oh.
It was successful. Carl Maybeck was an old buddy of mine. Do you remember Carl Maybeck?
I didn't know him, but was he a teacher?
He was a high school teacher.
Yeah.
He was in high school. He and I were in the third grade together in Wichita.
Oh.
And so we've always gotten along well together, and I shared his views toward the developers in Lawrence, and so I got behind him when he won his campaign. I lately have been contributing to causes that, instead of being active personally.
Yeah. Will you have continued involvement with KU then?
I've never stopped, actually. It is, in a way, increased since retirement. Since I don't have the obligation to go to class, I am promoting Latin America through the KUEA and the Alumni Association. And so what does this mean? Well, first of all, I established a scholarship fund for Central American research. And I'm trying to persuade the KUEA to increase its size. And I have an appointment. I've been seeing people in the KUEA.
And that is the Kansas?
The Endowment Association.
Yeah.
And so I'm very disappointed that in the entire period that I've been at KU, there's never been much effort on the KUEA to bring money in for Latin American studies. Mm-hmm. The largest, by far the largest, and just about the only donation has been the Griffith Endowment. And so that's a shame. It seems to me that there should be working. And so I've established upon retirement, actually 5 years before retirement, I started a small fund, and now it's up to $60,000. So that's for a Central American scholarship. I won't use it until we get up to $250,000.
So you talk to people and convince them to give money?
I gave them money.
Oh, I see.
Yes. And so, and in fact, if I had to say anything about my accomplishment, it's from Depression times to a situation where, because of TIA craft and good investment, I'm able to give money to establish a scholarship fund.
Yeah.
And I announced on this last trip that we were going to establish a Paraguayan fund. And I issued a challenge of $5,000. I said I would give $5,000 if the partnership would raise $5,000. Well, after 2 days, we were up to $10,000. And so I'm pushing for that as well.
Uh-huh.
But I want it to be Regents-wide.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm having a little trouble with KUEA because they don't like to think they're raising money for anybody else.
Oh.
So we'll do it probably outside KUEA. And with the Alumni Association, they are very good about organizing Kansas graduates in Los Angeles and Dallas and Kansas City and so forth, and also London and Berlin and Tokyo, but they don't give a hoot about San Jose or Asuncion, because they don't have lots of money to give.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to turn that around, and I have people. So I'm working to establish a network of people at the university who will push for raising money for Latin America. There was one instance of success. Back in 1999, we had a symposium here on Costa Rica, and I raised $50,000 on campus and off campus in order to fund that symposium. So I know it can be done. Uh-huh. You just have to go for it.
Yeah. Well, you've certainly been busy with a lot of things. Anything else you plan to do in retirement?
I'd like to do a lot of things.
Sure.
But I proposed that we do a history of the Kansas-Paraguay relationship. When I backpedaled on the book, I published one little book on the Costa Rica program, 100 pages. I call it a booklet. Mm-hmm. Originally I intended to cover the whole period, but in the history of the KU University of Costa Rica program is so interesting, its origins, that I only got up to 1962, and we just decided to go ahead and publish it.
So you would like to continue?
I'd like to finish that. I don't think I'm going to have that opportunity, but I would like to do. I have a collaborator. If I can get him to do all the work, we will do a book on Kansas Paraguay. And that's one of the reasons I was in Topeka this afternoon.
Oh. I think I read somewhere that you like gardening. You still garden?
I've been through that. I lived on a farm for 15 years, and I had a tractor, I had a John Deere mower, and I enjoyed playing farmer. It was sort of recapturing my youth when I was in the driving a tractor in the 1940s. But so, yes, but I raised vegetables, and my wife raised flowers, and that was then. But when Mary Ellen died, we were already thinking about moving to town, and so I left the farm, and I moved in with Mary Miller, whom you may know. She has very close contact with the university. Her daughter, Shelley, was the director of Spain, Portugal, and Latin America, and was a student of mine. And she lives right close to the university. And so we had somebody come in to do the landscaping. So we're just watering it.
Yeah.
So gardening is not high on my priority list right now.
Yeah. What is your assessment of KU, Latin American studies, past, present, hopes for the future, that kind of thing?
Well, I think I've touched on that in that I am concerned that it is, I'm very happy that it's been funded with federal money.
Yeah.
But what's happening in other Latin American studies programs around the country is that private funding has been making the real difference. And for whatever reason, the university has not pushed for private funding for the center. And so there are not many good scholarships, and there's nothing really special, no special benefits available to students through the Center of Latin America Studies. in comparison to Tulane or some of the other competing institutions. So I'm not content to just sit by and watch that happen. I want to make it. I want to help it make it improve myself.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention that I didn't ask?
No, I think I probably, I think your questions were pretty thorough. I did bring a little, another, but you don't collect papers, though, do you? I mean, you're not, this operation is not collecting data.
Well, what will happen?
That I might mention is poetry.
Oh.
And as a Spanish major, I read a lot of poetry.
In Spanish?
Yes, and didn't pay much attention to it. But I have a very strong feeling about Nicaragua. And it's partly because I know a lot of poets in Nicaragua. And Nicaragua is a very special place because the intellectual community is very tightly knit. So after spending several months there, I began to realize that I knew the historians and the musicians and the poets and the literary figures. Whereas in the United States, if you're channeled in one direction, you don't have this broad assortment of friends in the,
yeah,
in the cultural community. And among these various individuals, poetry was very prominent because almost everybody in Nicaragua considers himself a poet. And that's because of the great poet Rubén Darío of the late 19th and early 20th century, the founder of modernism, one of the key movements in Latin American poetry. So I think a lot of people would argue, whether Nicaraguan or not, that the most important poet in Spanish in the past 200 years would be Rubén Darío. Well, you can imagine that if a little country like Nicaragua could produce this great poet, then a lot of people in Nicaragua think of themselves as poets. And so I got to know Ernesto Cardenal real well. He is a priest poet and probably the number one poet in Spanish today. Some people would argue that. There are other, you know, it's kind of like who's the number one university in the United States. It depends on how you look at it. Anyway, just in the next month, I'm going to give a lecture at the Unitarian Fellowship on my experience with poetry in Nicaragua. In the case of Cardenal, he was a Sandinista, a pistol-packing priest, and he became the Minister of Culture. I interviewed him on several times. I tried, like the Dickens, to get him here to KU. He never found the time to come here. But I saw him on several occasions, and I ran into him way back in 1969. I bought his Poesía Revolucionaria, Revolutionary Poetry, under the counter during the Somoza dictatorship. And I just feel very strongly about Nicaraguan poetry. So, and it's made me, to my amazement, in my last 5 years, I'm starting to write poetry myself.
And write in Spanish or English?
I write in English, but I'm using the Cardenal technique. The Cardenal technique is to be not so spiritual as you might think a priest would be, but very focused on specific names and references around you. So he wrote, for example, can you imagine a priest writing a poem on Marilyn Monroe? He did. And it's really very moving. So I've been writing poetry in my odd moments. And I'm having a ball.
What sort of subjects do you favor?
Really, I have such a wide range that I write about colleges, specific colleges that I've been to.
Oh.
I write about universities that I've been to. I write autobiography. I have one called I Feel Guilty, about people asking money for donations, and sort of a humorous poetry. Oh. I write, instead of writing a Christmas letter, I write Christmas poetry. My Christmas letter is Christmas poetry.
My goodness.
So I find that I wake up in the middle of the night and I just, that's a poem.
My goodness.
And it all goes back, I think, a combination to being a Spanish major at one time and having so many friends in Nicaragua who are poets. The old saying is in Nicaragua that if somebody reaches in his pocket like this, it's not a gun he's defending himself because he knows you're going to read him his poetry, so you got to read him first.
Well, that's something interesting to do in retirement, too.
Yes, yes, it is. I'm enjoying it. My partner is afraid I will try to publish some of these, but but I don't care. I'm not thinking about publishing them. I'm just doing it for fun.
Okay. Well, I guess that's about it.
I guess that's about it.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for listening.